Could be we have a problem with that new number three gun, Skipper, Kettle suggested darkly. Maybe it goes off completely by mistake. Blows that bitch clean out of the sky. Terrible accident. Sincere regrets. We all go to the funerals. Now, Mr. Kettle. You know I would never condone such an action. He glanced aside and added in a whimsical undertone, at least, not when it could be traced back to Predator. He narrowed his eyes, scanning the decks of the Mist Shark for familiar faces. Still, you know she took that slip intentionally. Make ready a side party, if you would. She'll be here to gloat in a moment.
There could be a horrible accident with a gauntlet, Kettle growled.
If you please, Mr. Kettle, Grimm said, keeping a firm note of reprimand in his tone.
Side party. Aye, aye, Captain, Kettle said, and stomped off, muttering under his breath.
Grimm nodded and went back to his cabin. He picked up his nicer bottles of liquor, his cutlery, his gauntlet, and a number of small, valuable objects, placed them all in his heavy cabinet, and locked it. And then he made the bunk neat and turned up his crystal lamps to their brightest levels. By the time he had finished, he could hear men on the deck of Mist Shark shouting. Her captain would be on the way. Grimm went back out on deck and eyed the other ship. A lean woman of an age with him, but half a foot taller, was coming down the gangplank onto the pier.
No!
She said firmly to the burly, one-eyed ape of a man walking beside her, Mist Shark's first mate, Santos.
I absolutely forbid it. Unless you can find a way to make it look like it was someone else's ship that had the accident.
Santos spat out a curse, scowling, and put his hands on his hips. He glowered at his captain, and then up at the deck of Predator. The woman took notice of Santos's reaction, and turned on a low, heavy boot heel to gaze up at Grimm. Her expression turned into a perfectly amused smile. She wore an aeronaut's dark leather pants, a white blouse with roomy sleeves, and a tailored vest bearing intricately embroidered designs. She swept a hand up to her head and doffed her cap, giving him a formal bow, her arms spread at her sides. Grimm scowled. When she straightened again, the woman replaced her cap and said,
"My dear, dearest, lovely Francis, you look absolutely delightful."
Grimm folded his arms and continued to scowl. The woman laughed.
"Francis, I do hope that in your usual charmingly predictable and courteous way, you have prepared to receive me.
I'm coming aboard.
With your permission, of course."
"Kettle keeps asking me to let him shoot you, Captain Ransom."
"Oh, but you never would,"
Ransom replied, smiling.
"Not Francis Madison Grimm of the Albion Ethereum Fleet, even though he isn't."
Grimm gave her a sour smile. "Let's get this over with, shall we?" Ransom put a hand to her chest and made a sad face.
"Oh, sweet Francis, you wound me with your lack of enthusiasm."
"I shall certainly wound you if you try to take anything that isn't yours while you're here."
"Everything's mine, Francis," she replied in a merry tone. "The only question is whether or not it knows it yet."
Grimm jerked his head toward Predator's gangplank in a peremptory gesture, and walked toward it without ever quite turning his back entirely on Captain Ransom. The woman strode down the pier and around to Predator's gangplank with steady, quick strides, and came up the ramp like a visiting monarch.
"Side party," Kettle snarled. "Tension!"
Tension indeed, Grimm thought. Half a dozen armed men, three on either side of the gangplank, snapped to attention, and every single one of them kept his hand on his sword, his gauntlet primed and gently glowing. Kettle faced the gangplank and gave his best glare to Captain Ransom as she came up to the deck.
"Sweet Kettle,"
Ransom said. Something quite predatory came into her smile.
Does your knee still ache when it rains?
Aye, Kettle snarled. And I make it feel better by breaking the noses of mouthfully sucker-punching, welching, treacherous Olympian bit Mr. Kettle, Grimm said, his tone hard. Captain Ransom is my guest. You will maintain courtesy and discipline aboard my vessel, or I shall terminate your contract. Do I make myself perfectly clear?
Kettle looked over his shoulder at Grimm sullenly. He grunted. Then he turned and snapped off a textbook salute to Captain Ransom.
Ransom returned it genially. Permission to come aboard?
Granted, Kettle said through clenched teeth.
Grimm stepped forward and cleared his throat. Conditionally, Captain Ransom. I believe you are familiar with my terms.
Ransom beamed and unfastened a gauntlet. Kettle stepped forward warily to accept it. Then she unbuckled her sword belt and passed that over as well.
Satisfied?
And the knives in your boots, if you please, Grimm said.
She reached down and withdrew two slender copper-clad blades from the tops of her boots, smiling without a hint of shame or repentance as she surrendered them.
I only put them there to give you an excuse to gaze at my lower half, Francis.
How thoughtful, Grimm replied, his tone disinterested.
What's that at the small of your back?
Ransom reached behind her, and every man in the side party rattled their swords to make sure they'd come clear of their scabbards if need be. Her smile widened, and she produced a small silver flask.
A lovely drop I picked up in Ethosia. You'd like it.
Fool me twice. Shame on me, Grimm said. You won't be needing it.
She rolled her eyes and passed the flask over as well.
Don't you touch a drop of that flask, Kettle.
No worries there, Kettle growled. I know where it's been.
Ransom ignored the comment loftily.
Anything else, Francis?
She bobbed an eyebrow at him.
Should I strip out of my clothes as well?
That shall not be necessary, Grimm replied stiffly. Ransom winked at him.
I do so appreciate the courtesy that is always shown me when I visit the second fastest ship in the sky.
Grimm felt a flicker of utterly irrational annoyance at the mention of the race, and had to fight to keep from clenching his jaw.
It is how decent, civilized people behave, Captain Ransom, though I suppose that to someone of your level of moral fortitude it must seem remarkable.
She barked out a quick laugh.
I would say you'd scored a touch, Francis, if I had the least shred of desire for your good opinion.
She strode across the deck breezily.
Don't bother to show me the way to your cabin, Captain. I'm sure I'll find it in the same place.
Grimm watched Ransom walk away, and permitted himself a slow exhalation and a narrow-eyed glare. Kettle stepped up next to him, his eyes wary.
That woman, Grimm said quietly, drives me quite insane.
Kettle grunted.
Why'd you marry her, then?
Grimm followed her to his cabin and shut the door behind them. He leaned his shoulders back against the door and folded his arms over his chest, mostly to use his right arm to support his wounded left.
All right, Calliope, he said. What are you going to make me regret this time?
She tossed her hat casually onto his writing desk, settled onto his bunk, and stretched out along it with a smug assumption of the space.
Perhaps I missed you. Can't I pay an old friend a social call?
Friend, he said, his tone carefully devoid of emotion. Empirical evidence suggests that you cannot.
She smiled, the expression impish, her green eyes sparkling in her strong, square face. Had an artist painted Calliope, no one would accuse her of extraordinary beauty, but somehow it was present in any case. In the way she held her head, the glitter in her eyes, in her sheer physical confidence. A still-life image of her was something of an oxymoron. Calliope was never still. Even when she was seemingly motionless, he could see her mind at work, sorting ideas, seeking solutions, cataloguing the space around her. To see her beauty, one had to see her in motion.
"You've grown so cynical since the Admiralty cashiered you for obeying orders, Francis," she said. "It's most unbecoming."
Grimm simply stared at her.
Calliope rolled her eyes. "I'm almost certain I remember you having a sense of humour sometime in the murky past, at the dawn of history."
"We used to have a lot of things," Grimm said in a neutral tone. "What do you want?"
"I want to make you an offer. An easy job with an excellent profit margin."
"How believable," Grimm said. "But I'm afraid I'd rather not lose another year's earnings to your amusements."
"It isn't about money," she replied.
"Since when?" Grimm said mildly.
"I'm doing quite well for myself now," Calliope replied.
"Why, not a month ago we stumbled upon a damaged Cortez-class merchantman. She'd had a battle cruiser escort, but apparently it went herring off in pursuit of some dim-witted band of amateur pirates who had made a mess of attempting to take her. Her entire belly was as naked as a newborn. Took the ship and her cargo, sold them, and ransomed back her crew. I've enough money to bathe in at the moment."
Grimm snorted and opened his door. "I believe I've heard enough. Good day, Captain Ransom."
"No,"
she replied, her eyes hardening.
"You haven't heard enough. Not yet. Hear me out. Give me 1 minute. If you don't like the offer, I'll go."
Grimm twisted his mouth into a frown. "We're done here." Calliope sat up, her brows knitted, her gaze intense.
"Mad,"
she said very quietly.
"Please."
Grimm stared at her for several seconds. Then he shut the door again.
1 minute, he said.
"Due to a clerical error, I find myself double-booked," she said. "I've half a load of vat sand bound for Olympia, and the other full of medicine bound for Kissarm. I can't make both deliveries in time. Help me out by taking the Olympia run, and I'll split the net profits with you."
"In theory, I should think a 90-10 split would be more reasonable," Grimm said.
"You want 90% of my cargo?" Calliope asked.
10% and a solid reputation is a great deal more than nothing in a broken contract," Grimm said. "Theoretically." She narrowed her eyes.
"Oh, there's no point in trying to argue with you over this."
"None whatsoever. I'm not the one who needs help." She pressed her lips together and then nodded once.
"You leave me little choice, it would seem."
"In fact, I leave you none at all. I'm not available. That battlecruiser you mentioned gutted Predator. It'll be days before we can put Sky under her again."
Calliope frowned. "What? She's not Sky-worthy."
"Yet," Grimm said. Those green eyes slipped into calculation and seemed to reach some sort of conclusion. She rose abruptly and reached for her hat.
"Then I suppose I should seek help elsewhere. I'm sure someone would like the work."
Grimm nodded and opened the door for her. Captain Ransom strode out of the cabin and over to the gangplank, where Kettle warily returned her effects. She glanced back over one shoulder at Grimm just for a second, and then departed the way she had come. Kettle came over to his side.
"What does she lie about?"
Grimm shrugged. "I'm not certain. All of it likely. Said she had an easy money job for us." Kettle snorted. "Precisely."
"And you told her no,"
Kettle said rather carefully.
"Of course I did."
The pilot sagged a little with evident relief.
"Ah, fine. It's never good news when she shows up."
Grimm found himself frowning thoughtfully. "No. No, it isn't."
"Sir?"
"Mist Shark arrives, just as the Spire comes under attack," Grimm asked. "Are we to think it a coincidence?" Kettle grunted.
"What do you mean?"
The Spyrark sent us down to landing to smoke out an enemy force, Grimm said. And it just so happens that by chance the fastest ship in the skies docked in the landing shipyard. Kettle scowled.
Predator only lost that race because Santos sabotaged our main Hassler cage.
Regardless of how it happened, she won, Grimm said.
She claimed the fame and glory. Such renown is a marketable commodity.
Kettle's frown deepened.
You think she's enemy transport?
I am disturbed by the presence of inordinate levels of coincidence, Grimm said.
I want eyes on Mistshark at all times. Report anything, no matter how trivial.
See it done.
Kettle nodded.
Aye, sir.
Grimm narrowed his eyes thoughtfully. And after that, send Mistress Journeyman and Stern to my cabin, please. Kettle's concerned frown twisted up into a little smile, and his eyes glittered with a sudden malicious light.
Ah, yes, sir. I'll be delighted to.
Chapter 32 Spire Albion, Havel Landing, Ventilation Tunnels. Major Ispira seized the sword from the hand of the Auroran Marine braced at attention in front of him. He held up the weapon and inspected it minutely before snarling.
You've allowed the copper to wear through, right there, Marine.
He held up the weapon a few inches from the Marine's eyes, so that the tiny spot of brown-red rust was clearly visible.
The iron rot's already begun. Can you see that?
Yes, sir,
the Marine said.
Why do we clad iron and steel with copper, Marine?
The Marine's cheeks coloured slightly.
To prevent iron rot from destroying the weapon, sir.
Excellent. You do know. And once the iron rot sets into the steel, how long will it be before it spreads from this point and turns the entire thing to rust?
A few days, sir. Give or take.
Espera nodded.
This weapon will not kill whom you need it to kill if it shatters on the first stroke, or snaps when you attempt to draw it from the scabbard. I don't mind if your carelessness kills you, but it might also kill your brothers in arms, myself among them, when you fail to fulfill your duty.
The Marine swallowed, staring ahead, and said nothing.
Well, what have you to say for yourself, Marine?
No excuse, sir, he replied.
Espera passed the weapon back with a sharp motion and said, Report to the armorer. Scour the rust off and seal the bare spot with lead. Once that is done, you will perform maintenance on every spare weapon in the armory, and you will do so with flawless attention to detail.
Understood?
Yes, sir,
the Marine replied, saluting. Espera glared all the way down the line of Marines from 2nd Company's 1st Platoon.
In fact, why don't all of you prepare your weapons and gear for inspection? Again.
When I return in 1 hour, each and every man of you will turn yourselves out like Aurora Marines or God in heaven bear witness. I will send every one of you up the ropes.
The faces of more than 20 hard-bitten professional soldiers went pale in a single wave of acute unease, and Espera let the silence weigh heavy before he said,
Dismissed!
The Marines all executed a drill-ground right face, despite not being ordered to, and marched quietly and efficiently away from the intersection chamber and back down the length of ventilation tunnel to the designated bivouac area.
Barely looked like a real spot to me, Major,
rumbled a deep-chested voice from behind him.
Espera turned to find Sergeant Siriaco, standing a few feet away, having approached in total silence. The warrior-born Marine threw him a crisp salute, which Espera returned with equal precision.
Sergeant, once upon a time, the first sergeant I worked with taught me to keep nervous men focused on their mission with familiar routine and fear of my wrath if they deviated from it.
The other man relaxed, smiling a bit.
Did he? He teach you anything else?
Only to never expect him to arrive in a timely fashion. Espera said, not quite allowing himself a smile.
Where is Lieutenant Lazaro?
Siriaco's feline eyes glinted with buried rage.
Dead, sir.
Espira tilted his head.
How? He ignored my advice and made a bad call, Siriaco said.
Ran into what he thought were civilians tending wounded after the airstrike. He tried to bluff his way past them instead of shooting them and moving on with our payload.
Why?
One of them was a pretty girl. Looked like a porcelain doll. He was young, sir. Espira frowned and nodded. Chivalry was a virtue held in high esteem in the upper echelons of Spire Aurora. It took young officers time to learn how seldom it could be indulged in combat. Unfortunately, actual combat could often be abruptly, lethally parsimonious in the matter of how much time it gave young soldiers to learn.
What happened?
They caught on to him, and a little doll lit up his face with a gauntlet from about 2 feet away.
Espira grunted. Damn, the boy had promise. At least it was quick.
The battery? The sergeant shook his head. Waited for the strike team to rendezvous, but they never came, and we never got the explosives to them. Some kind of reserve fleet officer with far too much initiative assembled a militia, brought it into the tunnels, and intercepted us. I presume the battery team is dead, sir.
Bah! Espira said. It was only a side errand, and a sensible gamble.
But it would have been a nice feather in our caps to have destroyed that damned crystal shop of theirs. He tilted his head, frowning at Siriaco.
Are you shot, Sergeant?
A bit,
Siriaco said.
It'll pass. Damn fool, Lazaro. Lost half the squad.
He squinted down the hallway after the departed platoon.
Would you really send him up the ropes, sir?
Half a tithe of my strength? Don't be absurd. But at the moment, they need something to fear more than a spire full of angry Albions. Siriaco's nostrils flared, and his eyes shifted to one of the other tunnels leading off from the intersection chamber.
That way she is here.
Mind your tone, Sergeant, Espira said to the larger man. You're one of the finest soldiers in Spire Aurora, but we all have our orders.
Yes, sir.
Espira nodded, and then followed the sergeant's glance to the darkened tunnel. Madame Cavendish's batman, Sark, stood at the entrance to the tunnel, a sober, frightening figure in black, his wall-eyed face locked into an expression of perpetual boredom. No one with half an ounce of brains in his head would mistake him for anything but a lethal sentry. Espira had been blocking it from his attention deliberately, with constant attention to the men, but now that all voices had fallen silent, he could hear it again. A high, pitiable, hopeless keening sound that came drifting brokenly out of the darkness.
Ren? Siriaco asked in a whisper. A verminositor stumbled onto the base. Espira replied equally quietly. We caught him, but not his partner. He says he was alone. She is here to verify his story.
Knives? The warrior-born guessed. Espira shook his head and suppressed a shudder.
She took nothing with her. She's a mad beast, Siriaco said.
She is our mad beast, Espira corrected him. Be glad she is on our side. The warrior-born narrowed his eyes, staring intently at Sark, and rolled one of his shoulders stiffly, as if it pained him.
No, sir.
Major,
he said, I don't think I will.
Just then, footsteps sounded in the black hallway, firm and decisive. A moment later, Madame Cavendish emerged from the darkness. She paused at Sark's side, and her batman handed her a small towel. It was only then that Espira noted that her nails and fingertips were wet and scarlet. The sobs in the tunnel continued unabated. The Etherealist calmly discarded the cloth and walked over to Espira, Sark loomed in her wake.
Major,
she said,
we have had a stroke of luck. He was indeed working alone, though he believes there will be a search for him in the next 24 hours or so.
Disappear the body, ma'am?
God in heaven, no, she replied. That would only make the Verminosters Guild turn out in increasing numbers, searching more and more tunnels to find one of their own. Take the body and leave it where it will be found in the next few hours. Then there will be no search.
Espira nodded slowly, struggling to keep his face neutral. He looked down at the darkness from which weak sounds of despair still drifted. He's alive, ma'am.
What is left in that tunnel is a technicality,
Cavendish said.
But it wouldn't do to have him found with sword strokes and blast wounds in him.
She mused for a moment and then smiled.
Send him up the ropes.
Espira felt his throat tighten again, and his stomach twisted at the idea of doing that to any man, much less a hopeless, broken one. Ma'am?
No more than a minute, or there won't be enough left to be identified,
Cavendish said. She paused, and then said, her voice harder,
Do you understand, Major? Do you know how long a minute is?
Espira ground his teeth, but said, Yes, ma'am.
Very well. Do your best not to interrupt my preparations again, won't you, dear? I'm expecting guests, and I must be ready to receive them.
With that, she turned and began walking calmly away. Sark watched them in silence until she was several paces away, and then he turned to follow her. Siriaco waited until Sark was gone to let out a low, leonine growl. "We work with the materials we are given, Sergeant," Espira said. The sobbing continued in the darkness.
"Ren," Siriaco said quietly, "don't order me to send a living soul up the ropes."
"Of course I won't, old friend," Espira said quietly.
"Break his neck. Send up the corpse. Dispose of it as Madame Cavendish specified."
Espira could feel Siriaco's gaze on him. And then the warrior-born marine sighed and nodded.
"Yes, sir."
Chapter 33 Spire Albion, Habel Landing. Bridget had nearly fallen asleep when, a number of hours later, both bored-looking cats abruptly whipped their heads in the same direction, ears pricked forward as if they'd heard something, although Bridget hadn't, beyond the normal muted noises of later hours in the Habel. After a moment, both cats simultaneously rose, stretched, and yawned.
"Folly, wake up," Bridget said. "It's time."
Folly blinked her eyes open from where she'd been dozing with her head against the wall and looked around, apparently disoriented.
"Whose time is it?"
"Shh," Bridget said, listening intently.
"Adequate,"
Raoul asked the other cat.
"So it would seem,"
the strange cat replied.
"Introductions."
"Appropriate."
Both cats turned at the same time and sauntered toward Bridget and Folly, walking exactly shoulder to shoulder. Folly peered sleepily at them as they approached and whispered to her jar,
"I wonder which of them won."
Bridget felt her eyebrows lifting.
I believe it was a draw," she whispered back.
"This is a formidable member of his tribe," she sighed. "Just our luck. When we're in such a rush, to meet someone who could ignore Raoul for so long."
"Ought we stand up?"
Folly asked her jar worriedly.
"Won't it be seen as disrespect if we do not? A human who is sitting down is a human who cannot possibly pounce on a cat faster than the cat can spring away," Bridget replied. Stay sitting. It's more polite.
Oh, Bridget makes it perfectly sensible,
Folly said, smiling.
I'm so glad I wondered aloud.
Raoul prowled over to Bridget and settled comfortably in her lap.
Oh, said the strange cat, they belong to you. I had wondered why they waited about.
This one belongs to me,
Raoul said, leaning his head up to nudge the underside of Bridget's chin.
That other one works for me.
With you,
Bridget said beneath her breath. Raoul flicked a careless ear.
It's the same thing.
He turned to the strange cat and said,
I'm Raoul, Kit of Maul of the Silent Paws. This is Little Mouse. That one has not yet earned a real name.
Her name is Folly, Bridget put in, saying all but Folly's name in cat.
No real name,
agreed the other cat.
I am Neen, Kit of Norn of the Nine Claws.
I have heard of the Nine Claws, Raoul said. They seem perfectly adequate.
I have heard of the Silent Paws,
Neen replied.
I find nothing overly objectionable about them.
The humans of my Havel sent Little Mouse here to ask for help from cats.
Neen lashed his tail thoughtfully.
That seems overly intelligent for humans.
I thought the same, Raoul said. Little Mouse, ask.
Bridget stared calmly at Neen, matching the cat's enigmatic, confident expression as best she could.
If it is not too much trouble, I would like to speak to your clan chief.
Neen tilted his head and returned her stare.
It almost sounds like a cat.
It sounds precisely like a cat,
Raoul replied, some of the hair along his spine rising.
Little Mouse is mine, and I will thank you to remember it.
Bridget ran a hand down Raoul's spine in just the way he most preferred and hastened to add,
I know that this request is unusual, Neen, Kit of Norn, but it is very important to the Spyrarch, Lord Albion, and it may be that only the Nine Claws can help us. I beg your indulgence in this matter and will accept whatever decision you make in it.
Neen lashed his tail left and right for a moment before rising and saying,
It is Norn's place to decide, I think. Remain here. Norn will see you, or he won't.
Farewell, Raoul's Little Mouse.
Then he turned and vanished into the shadows.
Goodness, so abrupt,
Folly muttered.
Cats are not to be rushed, Bridget said. On the other hand, it's rather difficult to slow them down once they've decided to start.
She traced Raoul's ears with her fingertips and said to him,
I take it we should wait.
You should,
Raoul said approvingly, turning in a circle and then lying down in her lap.
I, however, am weary from all that diplomacy. I shall sleep.
The Nine Claws kept them waiting for all of half an hour. Then a pair of large male cats appeared from the shadowed hallway. They sat down at the very limits of Bridget's vision, where the yellow-gold gleam of their eyes was the thing she could best see.
Folly, Bridget said.
She touched Raoul's back lightly, and the cat lifted his head at once.
Of course, he said, and yawned. Now they are quick.
It's as though they have no consideration for others at all, Bridget said in a dry tone.
I suspect that they do not, Raoul growled, but this is their territory. We must show them.
He shuddered.
Respect.
Bridget nodded firmly and said to Folly,
Let Raoul walk first. Stay even with me, shoulder to shoulder, and try not to look at any specific cat for more than a second or two. It makes them uneasy. Very well.
Don't worry,
Folly said to her jar.
I'm here to protect you.
Yes, thank goodness for that, Bridget said.
rising as Raoul climbed out of her lap. She offered a hand to Folly and hauled the slender apprentice etherealist to her feet. Raoul looked back and up at them, his expression enigmatic, then turned and prowled forward. They followed the pair of male cats into darkness that rapidly swelled and swallowed them. Bridget would have been blind if not for Folly and her jar of expended lumen crystals. There must have been several hundred of the little crystals in the girl's container, each producing a faded remnant of its original glow. Any one of them could have barely produced light enough to be seen from the corner of one's eye, but taken together they cast a very soft, nebulous radiance that at least allowed Bridget to follow the cats without walking into a wall or tripping over debris on the tunnel floor. The pair of warriors, they could be nothing else given their size, their silence, and their arrogant demeanor, led them into the ventilation tunnels of the east side of the spire. While the builders had created Spire Albion in the shape of a perfect circle, each habel was laid out as a square fitting within that circle. The extra spaces, at the cardinal points of the compass, were filled with a variety of supporting structures, cisterns, ventilation tunnels, waste tunnels and the like. Cats generally preferred the smaller ventilation tunnels for habitation. Bridget could barely squeeze into one of the little tunnels and still wriggle forward, and she devoutly hoped that Norn would meet them in one of the larger tunnels or intersection chambers. It took them only a few minutes to reach a large intersection chamber where, apparently, the Nine Claws had decided to receive them. It was a roomy space, with ceilings that stretched up out of the meagre light of Folly's jar, 40 feet wide and perhaps twice as long. 8 ventilation tunnels intersected at this point, and the moving air of the spire's living breath swirled around the chamber, a constant droning sigh. The far side of the chamber featured several pieces of wooden furniture, including a footstool, a wooden chair, a high bar stool, and an impressive darkly stained table. They were lined up in that order as well, obviously as stairs leading up to what amounted to a dais. A score of warrior cats were arrayed on the various pieces of furniture, or on the ground at their feet up to the large table, where a single, heavily muscled tomcat of purest black sat with his eyes mostly closed. On the bar stool just below the level of the table sat Neen, with a bored expression, though his tail lashed left and right in agitation.
"He has his own furniture?"
Raoul demanded under his breath.
"Oh, that is simply outrageous. What is he doing with those? Cats have no need for such things."
"Why do I suspect you're going to want me to buy some for you?" Bridget asked.
"That is not the point,"
Raoul sniffed.
"We will discuss such matters later."
Bridget kept herself from showing any teeth when she smiled and looked carefully around the large chamber. There were a great many cats looking on. In the wan light Folly held, she could see little of them but for indistinct shapes and the flicker of reflections of green-gold eyes. Hundreds of them.
"Oh, my!" Folly whispered. "There are certainly more cats here than I've seen in the duration of my life. And, oh, look, kittens!"
Bridget arched a brow sharply and turned her head to follow the direction Folly was pointing out to her jar. She did, indeed, spy several tiny sets of eyes, many of them coming closer as the curious kittens crept forward, noses extended, their ears pricked toward the visitors. That was odd. Cats did not expose their kittens to humans. Even Bridget and her father, with their strong relationship with the Silent Paws, had seen kittens no more than half a dozen times in her life. And now the Nine Claws had received them in the very same communal chamber where their kittens were being cared for. In fact,
"This is all of them," Bridget breathed to Raoul. "This is the entire clan, kittens and all."
Raoul narrowed his eyes and made a quiet sound in his throat.
impossible. Too many tunnels must be watched and guarded and held against encroachers.
But even as he said it, Bridget saw his eyes scanning the room, taking an approximate count of their hosts.
"They're nervous,"
Folly whispered,
"banding together for safety."
"Cats don't do that," Bridget said, or began to say, but she stopped herself. Cats absolutely operated in groups to hunt and defend territory more safely. But they certainly did not ever allow themselves to appear to be doing such a thing. Such a lack of independence would be seen as unacceptable. Even a team of cats working together tended to be a loose coalition more than anything, and lasted no longer than was necessary. Clan chiefs like Maul or Norn maintained their position through a dense, complicated network of one-on-one relationships, through building a general consensus, and when necessary, through the exertion of personal pressure where possible, and force where necessary. Getting half a dozen cats to agree upon almost anything was the next best thing to impossible. Getting several hundred to move together, to abandon their individual territories, to share a single living space was unheard of, literally. From all she knew of cats, Bridget would never have believed such a tale if someone had told it to her. What in the name of God in heaven was happening in this habble? Raoul strolled forward through the chamber as if there weren't enough potentially hostile cats surrounding them to smother them all to death beneath their sheer weight. As deaths went, Bridget thought, being asphyxiated by warm, soft, furry little beasts seemed a bit less ghastly than some she had considered lately. But nonetheless, she preferred to avoid it. Raoul, generally speaking, knew very well what he was about, but when his natural ability and confidence failed, the results tended to be the sorts of events one felt obligated to write down in one's diary. She hoped, rather fervently, that this would not be one of those occasions. Raoul went straight to the lowest stool and mounted it as calmly as if it had belonged to him, and the cats who sat there were forced to give way awkwardly at the last moment, or else find themselves bowled over. Raoul proceeded up the pieces of furniture until he reached a high stool upon which sat Neen. Once he had reached that, Raoul calmly took a seat beside his counterpart and faced Norn attentively. Norn watched this display with narrowed eyes, and the tip of his tail twitched once or twice. Then he eyed Neen. Neen idly lifted a paw, cleaning it fastidiously. He was not precisely ignoring his clan chief, but he was, Bridget felt, walking near some sort of boundary. Norn's voice was a deep, growling tone.
"You are Raoul, of the Silent Paws."
"I know that,"
said Raoul. After a moment he added,
"Sire of the Nine Claws."
Norn growled in his chest.
"Arrogant, just like the other Silent Paws who have visited my domain."
"I know that too,"
Raoul said.
"You know why I've brought these humans to you?"
"Yes,"
Norn said. His green-gold eyes flicked to Folly and Bridget.
"They believe we owe them some sort of service."
"Sire of the Nine Claws," Bridget said, taking a small step forward. That drew the eye of every cat there. Bridget felt rather abruptly severely unnerved by the attention of so many consummate predators, however small each of them might be individually. She swallowed and kept her voice steady.
"Lord Albion, the Spirearch, sent us to request your aid in a matter in which we believe only the Nine Claws can help us."
Norn peered at Bridget and tilted his head this way and that for a moment.
"Is that some kind of trick, Kit of Maul? Like when the humans make those hideous dolls appear to speak?"
"It is no trick, sire," Raoul said easily. "This is my human, Little Mouse.
And it speaks.
Non mused.
As I told you,
Neen noted. The elder Nineclaw eyed his kit and considered his own front paws for a moment, as if deciding whether or not he needed to choose one with which to reply. Raoul feinted at Neen's nose with one paw, and the other young cat flinched. Instantly, every warrior cat in the place was on its feet, and Bridget felt almost certain that she could actually hear the mass of fur upon spines suddenly springing straight up. The air whispered with hundreds of low sounds of feline warning. Bridget found herself holding her breath. Raoul ignored the chorus of angry growls with a certain magnificent indifference to reality, looking at Neen in strict disapproval.
"Respect your sire," Raoul said severely, "or you will oblige him to teach you, here and now, when he obviously has greater concerns before him."
Neen blinked at Raoul several times. He took note of the room and all the cats staring at him, and abruptly became disinterested, looking out at nothing in particular, his eyes half closing. There was a long silence, and then Norn let out a low sound of amusement, and his ears assumed a more relaxed, attentive angle. Bridget felt her pent-up breath slowly easing out of her again, as several dozen of the watching cats joined their clan chief in sharing their amusement.
"You have courage, Raoul Silent Paw,"
Norn noted,
"or you are mad."
"I know that too," Raoul replied. "Will you hear Little Mouse's request?"
"Little Mouse,"
Norn said, his gaze travelling up and down Bridget's large frame.
"A fine name for her."
"She grew more than was expected," Raoul explained. "It was most inconsiderate, but what can one expect?"
"Humans rarely concern themselves with the needs of cats,"
Norn agreed,
"and those who do are rarely to be trusted."
Raoul lifted his chin.
"Little Mouse, Kit of Wordkeeper, is exceptional."
Norn studied Bridget with unblinking eyes for a time, then he said,
"Raoul, Kit of Maul, you are a welcome guest in my domain."
Raoul tilted his head sharply to one side.
"Whatever do you mean, sire?"
Norn's unreadable eyes for an instant were hot with rage.
"The Nineclaws are no friends to humans, no matter to whom they belong."
The older cat turned to stare hard at Bridget.
"Little Mouse, Kit of Wordkeeper, you and your companion are unwelcome here. You will depart immediately. You will not return to these tunnels, nor will you attempt to make contact with my clan. Should you refuse to abide by either of these commands, your lives are forfeit."
Bridget opened her mouth, startled. "But, sire, surely if you would only hear me out..."
"I know why you are here,"
Norn snarled, rising to all fours.
"I know you seek to enlist our aid as eyes and ears in the coming conflict, but you will not have it. The war is a human war. It is not a cat war. The Nineclaws will not care if your enemies slaughter every last man, woman, and child. It is all the same to us. We will go on as we have with whatever batch of humans rules this habble."
Bridget bit her lip.
Well, that was unacceptable.
She couldn't simply return and explain to Master Ferris that the cats had said no and what might be his next idea. Miss Lancaster would surely not simply abide by that conclusion. But what could be done? Within this setting, Norn's word was law. And though most people thought cats to be little more than vicious little vermin, good for mostly killing even worse little vermin, Bridget was perfectly aware that cats were willing and able to bring down human beings if they chose to do so. Norn could absolutely make good on his threat. If Norn so ordered it, none of them would leave this chamber. Even so, Bridget had a duty to perform. She had no intention of failing in it.
She squared her shoulders and took a deep breath, ready to try again. Folly abruptly seized Bridget's wrist, and the slender girl's fingers felt like cold, hard bronze.
No!
Folly hissed.
Can she not see it?
See what? Bridget whispered back. Folly turned her head slowly, her eyes raking over the chamber. The shadows, the silent, tense forms of the Nine Claws clan.
They are afraid!
Folly breathed, barely audible, her lips hardly moving at all.
They are being watched!
Bridget's mouth suddenly felt dry, her throat tight.
Here. Now.
Folly nodded her head in so slow and slight a motion that Bridget almost thought she had imagined it. Norn turned, the motion deliberate, his dark fur rippling in the dim light of Folly's jar, speaking in a slow, heavy voice.
You will be shown from this place and put on a path back to the human quarter of the Habble.
He paused to glance over his shoulder at Neen and said, his voice heavy with weariness,
Show them to the ropes.
Chapter 34 Spire Albion, Habble Landing, Ventilation Tunnels. Raoul, Little Mouse, and the slightly odder-than-usual human girl walked in a circle of Norn's hardiest warriors, half a dozen big, battle-scarred toms, most of whom were nearly Raoul's size. Each warrior wore a pair of fighting spurs, curved metal blades fashioned by humans and attached to leather cuffs that wrapped around the cat's rear legs. The spurs were sharp enough, when used properly, to be more than a little dangerous. Raoul felt that the escort was largely symbolic. None of them were his match, spurs or not, and Little Mouse, of course, was both armed and an exceptional human, with strength that had even impressed the half-soul Benedict. It would take a dozen experienced warriors at least to bring down a human like Little Mouse. Raoul growled in his throat. The first to try it would not live long enough to touch her. And that was what this was about. Norn had extended his hospitality, and with it his offer of protection, to Raoul. He had made no such offer for Little Mouse and Folly. Clearly, Norn had no love of humans, for which Raoul could hardly blame him. As a matter of history, cats had usually come to regret entanglements with humans. Humans were fickle, prone to changing their minds without warning or reason. There were very few reliable human beings, even with the half-souls among them, which was why those such as Little Mouse and Wordkeeper were so very exceptional. It was why no sane cat allowed kits to come anywhere near human beings. Humans seemed to feel that it was perfectly acceptable to teach kits to accept food from their hands as a matter of course, rather than teaching them the importance of hunting skill and self-reliance. Once one had to depend upon someone else for food, one had to depend upon someone else for life itself. To give humans such power over cats was an abomination. But it was far from the only indignity or injustice that humans had meted out over the centuries, including active hunts of cats at times, blaming them for things no cat would have done for any reason, attempting to poison their food supply or their water. Cats and humans regularly clashed in places where their understanding of the local human population was incomplete, and mutual pain was the inevitable result of such a breakdown of basic comprehension. If Norn had suffered through something like that, or if those he cared for had suffered, it could easily drive him to irrational hatred of even exceptional humans like Little Mouse. There were only a few reasons Norn would send them from his territory on a course so different from the one they had taken when they arrived, none of them pleasant. Certainly, Raoul thought, Norn meant for something to happen, something of which he did not, and perhaps could not, if Folly was correct,
speak aloud. Raoul's instincts kept repeating calmly that Norn intended to expose them to some kind of danger, which was perfectly fine. Raoul could handle any reasonable amount of danger, and between himself and Little Mouse, he felt that there were few challenges that need occupy his thoughts with undue concern. The real reason to him was why Norn would do such a thing. It seemed somewhat rude, especially to a visiting clan chief's heir. But then, Raoul did not yet know everything that was happening. Practically everything, he felt certain. But there might be some nuance to the situation, or to Norn's motivations, that the local clan chief intended to show him. Or it could be simple treachery. Raoul had no preference. In either case, he would deal with the problem and then respond to Norn in whatever manner was most appropriate and tasteful. When had he done anything else? The little group reached the mouth of a side tunnel, and the leader of the escort of Nine Claws Toms came to a halt.
"There," the cat said, "down that tunnel. Keep going, and it will lead you out into the human section of the Habel."
"Will it?" Raoul asked calmly.
"Yes."
"But you aren't going there," Raoul said.
"No."
"You are stopping here," Raoul said.
"Yes."
"Because you are afraid."
The other cat stared at Raoul with flat eyes. Raoul yawned his unconcern.
"If you wish to keep those eyes," he said pleasantly, "move them elsewhere."
"Raoul," Little Mouse breathed in protest. Little Mouse was such a tender, sensitive thing. Threatening to rip out someone's eyes was probably something she regarded as shocking, no matter how sincere Raoul might be, or how well-earned the threat had been. Raoul looked up at her fondly, then turned his attention back to their escort. The threat drew a response from the rest of the Nine Claws present, and they all turned to stare at Raoul. Raoul returned their gazes one by one, and one by one they turned disinterestedly away from him, as if they'd found their conflict to have suddenly become unspeakably dull. Raoul lashed his tail in satisfaction and said to Little Mouse,
"Shall we?"
"Of course," Little Mouse replied. "Would you like me to carry you?"
Raoul considered the question gravely.
"No," he decided. "You should be ready to use your gauntlet instead."
Bridget's eyebrows went up, but instead of protesting, she calmly rolled her sleeve all the way up and away from the gauntlet. As Raoul understood it, there was no real need for such an action, as long as Little Mouse didn't use the gauntlet too much, but the copper cages around the devices grew very hot after a time, and could set cloth aflame. Folly, meanwhile, stared at the new tunnel's blackness with wide, frightened eyes. Raoul approved. Fear was wisdom in a situation like this, and he was pleased that Folly was obviously intelligent enough to know it. He hoped that she would use the fear to make her cleverer rather than more foolish, but that was asking much of a human, relatively odd or not.
"I wonder," Folly said to the jar, "could we go another way? A way that is not down this tunnel?"
"Unlikely," Raoul said. "Norn means us to walk down that tunnel. To refuse him would be to challenge his rule."
"Oh dear," Folly said. "I think you should walk on my right," Little Mouse said to Folly.
Little Mouse was afraid. Raoul could hear her elevated heartbeat, but her voice was as calm and regular as a cat's. He felt that he deserved most of the credit for teaching her that.
"That way I can lift my gauntlet hand without bumping into you." "Oh yes, she's quite right," Folly said, nodding, and stepped up to stand a little behind Little Mouse and to her right. "But one of us should tell her that I would prefer another tunnel. Any other tunnel at all in the world to this one." "Hold the lights up, please," Little Mouse asked.
The sooner I can see a potential threat, the sooner I can attempt to blast it.
Folly solemnly lifted her little jar of crystals to her chin.
Thank you,
Little Mouse said.
I will